Agora a vinha é doce, vinha da Lu. Agora a vírgula foi sumando mim. Agora a vírgula vai ser virgindade. Agora a vinha canta a mocidade. Virgindade. Agora a vinha canta a mocidade. Agora a pérola não se vai embora. Agora vai a vinha e vai a sogra.
Ja, hallo, hier ist Felicia Herrschaft und heute im Studio Hugo Canuelas und Tobi Meyer. Ja, it's starting. Whenever it starts, it's the right time. So today we can spoke about different new aspects and presentations in the KV and we have some surprises. So, if you like to.
Ja, I'm very happy to be back on Radio X after I was here a while ago with Dora Hegi, who was one of the co-curators in the Transit exhibition. My name is Tobi Meyer. I'm a curator at the Frankfurter Kunstverein. It's opposite the Schieren Kunsthalle in Frankfurt am Main. And we will speak in English today because we have another guest from Hungary today here with me. It's a Portuguese artist called Hugo Canuelas, who, as Dora Hegi, now resides in beautiful Budapest. We will have three perhaps three topics to talk about today. First is Hugo's presentation in the Frankfurter Kunstverein. It's called Voto Octavio Pato, and it translates to Vote for Octavio Pato. And Octavio Pato, he was one of the driving forces behind the 1974 Carnation Revolution in Portugal, which was a peaceful revolution, and which liberated Portugal from the fascist Salazar regime. And in the aftermath of that Carnation Revolution, a series of street paintings appeared in the city. And these street paintings, they protest against fascism, but they also for a reform of the agrar politics. They are for a remodulation of the abortion politics in Portugal. So there's a series of topics that suddenly appeared in these street paintings. And they are very well documented on a website for the 25th of April 1974. And the artist who is here now with me has been inspired by these wall paintings. And he made a monument.
Okay.
A monument for Octavio Pato. And Hugo, maybe you can talk a bit about this working process here with us in Frankfurt, because you've been here for quite a while, and it's always good to have you back here in Frankfurt.
Well,
how was it for you?
First of all, good afternoon. My name is Hugo Canoevas, Portuguese artist living in Budapest. I've arrived to the stage of working with social realist paintings through the through a formal aspect of painting, and now I engage with a political and conceptual content that these paintings carry. These precise paintings are something really important for me and for my country, and they are not an end in itself, but they are a way of that should exist as a permanent struggle for what the people want, what they have to struggle. So the paintings are a kind of rare moment of Portuguese culture where people say what they want, and because the fascist regime incurred into people a very heavy kind of silent mood. So this is a kind of very special thing to which I pay homage to, in a way. I don't know if it makes sense.
I think it makes sense, yeah. And it's how do you feel about creating this, bringing these paintings together in a gallery context, Hugo?
First is because it's for the program called 10 Reasons to be a Member. This project is probably the edge of my practice, the last thing. And a Kunstverein is made of very experimental approach from the artist towards its practice, in a way. It's not, it doesn't have any sense to, in my point of view, to present something that I've done before, and then I present it as 10 reasons to be a member. So we create, me, you, choose, and this project was built in a sense of a new for me as well as an artist. This quite new for me as an artist. I've never done such a politically engaged artwork in a way.
And you are a member
of Kunstverein. We'll see now if
maybe we make him an honorary member.
Yeah.
We should do that with all the artists. Now, of course, in contemporary art, you know, there are some very interesting protagonists of monuments. Thomas Hirschhorn, for example. He has been doing a series of monuments for people that he admires.
Yeah.
You know, people he admires, not people that he know or people that he has particular relationships had with. But there's some precedence there. Would you see your work in line with the monument, like Hirschhorn's work? Or?
With all the difference between my work and this, and there are some similarities, and I cannot deny that I like it, and his work has been something who produced some changes in my practice in a way. I think is more accurate in terms of the conceptual elements of the monument in itself, and I think this monument, it's more poetical in a way, in the sense of a memory of something that I didn't live. I didn't live the years of the revolution, I was born after, and it is a kind of poetry inherent to the whole content that change the content. I change some of the sentences that they are written on the walls. If a German person will not see it, but the Portuguese person that would read the text, there are some changes in the text, small changes that it's also a critique to the static way of the Communist Party in Portugal, the way they behave. Or also a selection of things that I think Thomas Isshorn is almost pornographic in the sense of showing everything very raw and very direct. And I erased a few elements of it that I couldn't incorporate in my discourse, let's say. Certain things that I didn't depict on the paintings. So that's kind of poetical, or a way of trying to make a very strong idea into something that is more elastic and drives towards the... I don't like the idea of communism as a strong idea, or fascism as a strong idea, something that the end will happen anyway, doesn't matter what costs, this very strong idea of politics. So I use this poetics as a way of denying this, in a way. The most political thing aspect of the work is, I think, is the change on myself. That is, as a new, I forced myself to acknowledge something that happened in a way. I was not 100% sure or aware of all the implications, and working with this, discussing with Toby about the content, we both searching and finding things and finding meanings. You said the other day in a dinner, like, by the end you are a real socialist, and I think I've been discovering that I have something that is really left-wing with me, that I've been maybe denying or something. It's not a real presence, but with this work I found that there are things that I believe, not all, but some.
At the same time, it's sort of, we're not a museum. Yeah. We're a contemporary art center. We are heavily engaged in discourse and in production.
Yeah.
in the city. And on the other side, you would sort of think, okay, maybe if you understand yourself as a production unit of contemporary art, then do these paintings on the street, which is where they belong.
Yeah.
You know, somebody yesterday was saying to me, but it's all this effort and he's painting on the wall and then you paint over it and it's gone. And the only thing that I could reply was, but these paintings were made on the wall. You cannot transfer them on a canvas.
Yeah.
Like this one-to-one relationship. Maybe you, Hugo, you are of different opinion. Another person could come along and say, these paintings belong in the public domain. You know, you show them in a Kunstverein. On the other side, where they are placed in the Kunstverein, they are in the public domain, because you don't even have to pay to see them.
Yeah.
You know, you just have to come in. It's in the part of the Kunstverein which is, you know, accessible freely. You know.
Yeah.
Whereas beyond, you either have to be a member or you can pay entrance, and then there are all sorts of other sort of boundaries and restrictions. But maybe it's a bit too boring to talk about this. Felisa, maybe we can play a track by Los Super Elegantes, which is lined up. And then talk about the other exhibition, which also opened last night, with the title "Whenever It Starts, It Is the Right Time," and Jakob Kolding's new project in the Café of the Kunstverein. These two projects opened in parallel last night, together with Hugo Kanwilas' project "Vote for Octavio Pato." And they run until the 6th of May. So also during the Night of Museums, these three projects will still be running. And the project of Jakob Kolding, of course, will run for at least 1 year, because it has taken us almost a year to get him to the Kunstverein and redesign with us the walls of the Kunstverein. But now, just enjoy Los Super Elegantes.
Yeah, one second, Ben, if I can raise a short question about, because why is it important for you as an artist to make a poetic about yourself?
It's not about myself.
Maybe
the poetics is about a political fact. It's the memory is changed. Reality through poetics. It's the remembrance of something is changed by the way you would like to see it. It becomes poetical through that will, in a way. So that it's not totally true the way I might say the 25th of April revolution in that space, how I present it. It's just certain aspects of it and how I want to to see it in a way.
The sun is on the pool. The days are warmer there, so we will hide away. The days are longer. It's so. I'll come over to
Ja, das war Los Super Elegantes von einer CD, Channelizing Paradise heißt die. Yeah. Zwei Künstler, die in Kalifornien leben. Ich wollte noch kurz über die Ausstellung Whenever It Starts, It Is The Right Time sprechen. Die erste Gruppenausstellung oder besser gesagt kollektive Ausstellung, die im Frankfurter Kunstverein im Moment läuft. Die erste Gruppenausstellung, die von Jus Martinez und mir kuratiert wurde. 23 Künstler über verschiedene Generationen und aus verschiedenen Kontexten, sozialen Kontexten, aber auch geografischen Kontexten, stellen wir vor im Kunstverein bis zum 6. Mai. Darunter sind Künstler aus Lima und aus Brasilien, aber auch aus Frankfurt. So haben wir, jetzt sieht man, wenn man am Kunstverein vorbeiläuft, eine Arbeit von einem jungen Künstler aus Brasilien, Marcelo Cidade. Die Arbeit heißt Homem constrói sua casa própria e homem livre, was übersetzt heißt so viel wie der Mann, der sein eigenes Haus baut, ist ein freier Mann, was sich natürlich bezweifeln lässt, weil in der Welt, in der wir heute leben, vielleicht mit dem Hausbau auch einige Hindernisse und Behinderungen mitkommen, aber das ist auch eine direkte Geste zum Ausstellungstitel, weil wir mit der Ausstellung eben versuchen, auch die Frage von Agency, also des Handelns und der angewandten Vorstellungskraft vorzustellen und Möglichkeiten aufzuzeigen, beziehungsweise künstlerische Positionen vorzustellen, die sich mit Möglichkeiten beschäftigen, wie eine andere Zukunft gebaut werden kann, was ja vielleicht auch mit dem Thema von Hugo Canuillas ein bisschen in dem Sinne sich überschneidet, weil viele von den Künstlern eben auch wie Hugo vielleicht davon ausgehen, dass die Situation und die politische und die soziale Situation, in der wir heute leben, nicht der ideale Charakter sind und da eben Vorschläge gemacht werden, die auf andere Möglichkeiten hinweisen. Und das sind jetzt nicht nur kontemporäre Positionen, sondern wir haben ja auch mit Franz Mohn einen sehr alteingesessenen Frankfurter Künstler, der schon in den 60er Jahren Concrete Poetry Schreibmaschinenarbeiten gemacht hat, an die ja damals schon auf eine neue Sichtweise, eine neue visuelle Kommunikation, wie Franz das nennt, erarbeitet haben und in der mit Medienbildern überladenen Welt, in der wir heute leben, eine vollkommen neue Relevanz gewinnen. Und im Zusammenhang damit haben wir einen Stock darunter in Arbeiten von Sue Tompkins vorgestellt, eine englische Künstlerin, die in Glasgow lebt und die gestern Abend auch eine Performance gemacht hat, die Elephants Galore hieß. Und die eben auch mit Schreibmaschinen arbeiten, mit der Schreibmaschine arbeitet, aber auch viel größere Bogen Papier nimmt und eine Concrete Poetry darauf setzt, die aber ein Derivat ist, welches aus Comic-Magazinen stammt. Sue Tompkins verbindet somit also die konkrete Poesie mit den modernistischen Ansätzen, die sich oder popkulturellen Ansätzen, würde man vielleicht besser sagen, und entwickelt die konkrete Poesie auf eine Art und Weise weiter, wie es auch Franz Mohn eben gestern im Gespräch mit mir sagte, ist ihn doch sehr berührt, dass es doch noch in dem Zusammenhang jüngere Künstler gibt, die sich mit dem Thema so weiter beschäftigen können. Und Franz macht ja selber keine Schreibmaschinenarbeiten mehr, macht ja noch viele Hörspiele und ist also in dem Zusammenhang auch sehr aktiv. Und das ist zum Beispiel dann eine Achse, die Ausstellung so ein bisschen rotiert. Dann haben wir aber auch den Ansatz von kollektivem Denken, den man vielleicht doch auch, wenn man über angewandte Vorstellungskraft spricht, irgendwie mit in die Ausstellung mit hineinnehmen muss, obwohl wir hauptsächlich eben Einzelpositionen vorstellen. Dennoch zum Beispiel in Arbeiten wie von Raymond Chavez, dem Künstler aus Lima, oder von Luke Fowler, auch ein schottischer Künstler, der ebenso in Glasgow lebt, findet man eben immer wieder den kollektiven Ansatz, der sich entweder, wie im Falle von Luke Fowler, im Scratch Orchestra ausdrückt, wo eben verschiedene Künstler, Musiker zusammengekommen sind in London unter der Leitung von Cornelius Cardew, einem sehr bekannten Composer, den wahrscheinlich vielen der heutigen Hörer auch bekannt ist, und eben improvisierte, experimentelle Musik unter Anleitung von verschiedenen Mitgliedern immer wieder neu vorgestellt hat. Raimund Chávez hat eine erklingende Wand gebaut, die aus mit verschiedenen Medien spielt. Also es gibt dort eben Musik, die er mitgebracht hat aus Lima, aber auch Filme, zum Beispiel von Didi Haddock, der einen Film gemacht hat über die Darstellung der Latinoamerikaner im amerikanischen Kontext. Und Raimund hat in dieser erklingenden Wand eben einige verschiedene autobiografische Bezüge aufgebaut, und in dem Zusammenhang ist er auch auf Brigitte Mohnhaupt und deren Freilassung eingegangen und hat diese ganze Wand dann weiterhin verziert mit Plattencovern, die aus dem Bestand seines Onkels Record Label in Kolumbien stammen. Raimund kommt nämlich ursprünglich aus Kolumbien und dort gibt es ein Record-Label, das heißt Chávez, und die haben also ganz fantastische Covers. Das wird man dann sehen, wenn man mal in den Kunstverein kommt, dann kann man sich das angucken, dass das eine Kunst ist, diese Covers zu gestalten. Das Label gibt es leider nicht mehr, aber Raimund verwaltet eben weiter den Bestand, und neben eben dieser Arbeit, die er da als individueller Künstler macht, ist er auch aktiv in einem Kollektiv, das er mit seiner Frau Gilda Mantilla in Lima betreibt. In dem Kollektiv ist auch der Armando Andrade Teil, und die machen eben dann Street-Performances und haben ein Soundsystem, ein mobiles Soundsystem, mit dem sie rumfahren können und eben Performances machen auf der Straße. Weiterhin aber betreiben sie auch einen kleinen Kunstraum in Lima. Wenn man mal da ist, kann man sie sich anschauen. Das gibt jetzt nur so einen kleinen Eindruck in die Ausstellung. Ich habe jetzt so versucht, ein paar Arbeiten so ein bisschen vorzustellen. Wir haben auch ein Buch dazu entwickelt, herausgegeben im Frankfurter Revolver Verlag. Kann man im Kunstverein auch günstig erstehen. Das führt dann auch noch ein bisschen theoretischer in die Ausstellung mit ein. Ist vielleicht eher ein Werkzeug als ein Katalog. Es sind zwar Reproduktionen, Farbreproduktionen von den künstlerischen Arbeiten dort auch enthalten. Weiterhin haben wir vier Essays in Auftrag gegeben. Einen kommt von der Direktorin des Kunstvereins, Jus Martinez. Heißt die Wiederentdeckung des Vorstellungsvermögens, Anmerkungen zum Verständnis einer kollektiven Ausstellung, kollektive Ausstellung, wie ich am Anfang ja schon akzentuiert hatte. Dann der Direktor des Van Abbe Museums in Eindhoven, der Charles Escher, hat auch ein Essay geschrieben, der heißt Widerstand denken. Der in Paris wohnende Philosoph und Denker Brian Holmes hat einen sehr interessanten Essay geschrieben, Steigende Flut des Widerspruchs, Museen im Zeitalter des expandierenden Workfare-Status. Und der litauische Kunstkritiker im Urlaub, wie er sich genannt hat, Raimundas Malazauskas, hat einen Aufsatz geschrieben, eine Frau, die mich das Schreiben in ihrem Traum gelehrt hat. Und das ist auch ganz interessant, weil er da auf Lucy Edward Smith eingeht. Lucy Edward Smith is a fantastic artist, photographer. And in the context of Raimundas Malazauskas essay, Lucy Edward Smith becomes a woman.
Die Pfeifarbeit?
Die Pfeifarbeit ist von Adrian Piper.
Ah, ja, ja.
Ja. Und das ist eine 45 Minuten lange Klangarbeit. Die würde ich allerdings, glaube ich, nicht mit hier ins Radio bringen wollen. wo Adrian Piper, die Künstlerin, selbst eine Bach-Kantate nachpfeift. Beziehungsweise darüber pfeift. In der Ausstellung sind auch andere Frankfurter Künstler wie Thomas Beile oder der leider verstorbene Gerhard Wittner präsent. Also wie gesagt, also sehr verschiedene geografische Kontexte, sehr verschiedene Generationen sind vertreten. Wir sind auch ganz froh, dass Annabella Geiger aus Brasilien kommen konnte und einige Arbeiten auf Papier vorstellt. Da denke ich, dass man da doch einige Stunden bei uns im Kunstverein derzeit verbringen kann, um sich da zu informieren und sich die Ausstellung anzuschauen, verschiedene Eindrücke zu sammeln und eben auch Strategien für eine Zukunft oder für eine eigene Zukunft möglicherweise entwickeln kann.
Die unstetig vielleicht, ist.
Genau, die unstetig ist. Unstetig auf jeden Fall, ne?
Ja. Und das steht natürlich in der Spannung zu whenever it starts, it is the right time. Wenn the future is the strategy of something uncertain. Mhm. So what do you think?
When is what starting? Well, something is starting now, you know, or something has started when I met Hugo, you know, and I will run with him, you know, we will run through our life, you know, and we will accompany each other, in accompany each other's work. But whenever it starts, it is the right time, is a title like a pop song.
Yeah. I don't know what you think about that.
I think so.
It's like a pop song, but I have this idea, whenever it starts, it's the right time. There is no strategy out. That's an interesting construction in this sentence. Normally you would say, or in a kind of negative position, or in a critical position, you would say, it's always not the right time. But to say in an art context, it's always the right time, that's interesting. What has this to do with a new practice in the art world or in art context?
But we're not talking about new practices. We are not trying to
they are always
unveil,
there, but
we are
to
not
make
trying
them
to
visible.
Unveil the latest, hottest thing. You know, we with this exhibition, we demonstrate that we have a positive approach, you know?
Yeah.
You know, we want to like get things done, you know, we want to engage, you know, and this is something that is very important for a production contemporary art center like ours, you know, we are there, you know, we are listening, we are seeing, we are want to hear what people's opinions are, you know, and we want to make suggestions also for the future, and that is why we also established this room, you know, become a member of the Kunstverein is very important for us, you know, to engage with everyone in the city, because I mean with the densification of public space, units like spaces like ours, where you know discussions can happen, will become more and more important.
Yeah.
So we play another track, and then because I cycled home to get this, we will also play an excerpt from an interview that we conducted in London in about 1 year ago for radio station Resonance FM with the American conceptual godfather, John Baldessari. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to play this interview in its entirety while John had his solo show at the Porticus in Frankfurt. Unfortunately, now we don't have enough time, but we will play an excerpt after this track.
Yeah.
And then if you really want, you can contact me at the Kunstverein and I can make a copy for you of this.
Yeah.
Don't you know I'm loco?
Don't you know I'm loco?
Every sound takes you deeper and deeper. Nothing can disturb you.
Don't you know I'm loco?
Don't you know I'm loco?
And it's cool.
I'm in a castle.
Every time I pick up a paper, I always read bad news.
I love that track.
Don't you know I'm loco?
Don't you know I'm loco?
We'll be right back.
was from a Kid Loco, a DJ Kicks compilation. Not in six, it was the first track, yeah?
First and third.
First and third track. Well, the first one is by Kid Loco himself, and it's called Don't You Know I'm Loco? And loco means crazy.
Yeah,
yeah, in Portuguese
loco.
And in Spanish.
Yes.
As well. And the third one was by Swinsko Presence, the cinematic orchestra. And yeah, so as promised, you know, we're going to play an excerpt from that interview I made with a friend of mine, Andy Holden, with John Malalasari, when John had a solo show at Prudmagas Lee in London about a year ago. And he came to London, and Andy, he's a young artist from London who was in Frankfurt very briefly to study with Mark Leckie at the Städelschule. But Andy, he was fairly disenchanted with cuckoo-esque attitudes of art students at the Städelschule, and he retired from his short tenure here and returned to his warehouse in north of London and said he can work better there than here. And I tried to encourage him, come on, Andy, stay in Frankfurt, it's good for you, you know, it's a good school. He was like, nah, I can go back, I can meet Mark Leckie in London. And so anyway, he's a friend of mine, and he's very interested. He was very interested in John Baldessari's practice, and it was fantastic to have the two talking with each other. And so there you go. And then we play another track shortly before 4 o'clock. And but I want to wish you a very nice weekend already.
Thank you.
Should you push between these two?
I think you put your finger on it. I, as you suggested, started out as a painter and got increasingly uncomfortable, dissatisfied. Not so much with painting, but that painting was synonymous with art, and that's sort of the way I went to school. You know, and sculpture I wasn't into, but you know, the more figurative, you know, kind of sculpture, that sort of thing. And I got to, I think an impasse, and where I had all of these paintings around me, and somebody, I remember somebody had saying that at a certain distance, all paintings look alike. You know, because they're rectangular or square, and they have some colors on them. But you know, if you get back far enough, they kind of, you know, begin, you know, sort of looking alike. That's kind of a depressing thing to think about. But I just thought, you know, art could be more. And you know, then looking back, I found out a lot of artists were thinking that way. You know, getting uncomfortable with, you know, with painting, you know, as a dominant mode of expression. So I think that was, you know, just unrest. That was one of them, you know, that got me off in a different path. I think also that through high school, I had been interested in photography, but I got into that in a very weird fashion. I had taken a chemistry class and found this book on mixing your own developers. And I don't know, somehow I decided to do that. And then, of course, I would have to have something to develop, you know, so I had to take some pictures, which is a strange way to back up into photography. But then I got really hooked. And I would go to the local library and look at books on photography. And I got kind of feeling uneasy because what I was learning about photography, knowing nothing about the history of photography before, was that it seemed to have its own history. And I sort of knew a little bit of the history of art, and they didn't seem to merge in any fashion. And I said, well, it's all about imagery, you know, in some way, why, you know, what's the problem? So there, you know, that was a question that was in my mind. And then I think, as all art students learn out of art school, they have to find a way to make money, employ, you know, sustain their habit of being an artist. So I went into public school teaching, and you know, that was so exhausting that there wasn't a lot of time to paint. And then I quit a full-time job and try to find part-time teaching jobs and sort of, do one class, run back to my studio and paint for a while, go off and teach another class, run back and paint in a while. And I'm being slightly facetious here, but, you can say that photography's faster than painting. you don't have to just endlessly, make marks on a canvas with your brush. More seriously, I was sort of taking photographs as sort of visual note-taking. When I would do a painting, then I would go out, wander around with my camera, and record stuff that sort of looked like stuff I was painting. And then I would make prints of that stuff and put it up in my studio wall and look at it. Go ahead.
What piece maybe that springs to mind? The photographs of the back of the trucks.
Yes, that exactly.
And it looks,
they began to look. I sort of noticed truck backs, and I said, "Well, those are kind of like paintings, because they're flat and planar, and the rectangle is broken up in certain ways, and so on." Yes, exactly. And then more and more, I decided, why can't I just use photographic imagery? Why do I have to translate it into paint? And I realized the reason I was doing that was that's the way I was trained. Painting is art, art is painting, and nobody told me anything about photography. Then, that could be art. So I sort of more and more moved into photography, doing books, also wanting to have a broader audience than an art. And I think also a big motivation of doing books was to make cheap art, because I was teaching and I thought, why can't students have art, so they should be able, to buy a book for $5 or $10 and why not? That's art. So that was a thing too, yeah.
I mean, something when I sprung to mind when I was trying to think about how these two sort of played off each other in yours. There's this distinction that came back to this thing in Walt Benjamin in Illuminations, and he says that the painter is more like the magician. It's like a laying on of hands, and there's a distance and authority. And he says that the photographer is more like a surgeon. It's anonymous and it's sort of done undercover, but yet it penetrates the skin or something. And I don't know how much I agree with that, but with your stuff, it's like. But the thing about the distance, there's something like in yours when you. Thinking about the big Guggenheim images and the paint, stuff sometimes things go forward and things go back, and the photography and the painting somehow.
Well, I think, to pursue your question, which I still don't think I've really answered for you, I've been leading up to it. So I began doing straight photography, then, I remember my. First gallery exhibit second or third or something like that, in New York, all photographs, and a museum curator who knew my work looked around and said to me, look, you're still painting, but you can't get that out of your system, even though you move your means into photography. And it's true, there's a kind of visuality you develop as a painter that you just, you can't shake. Well, I think the other thing, too, is that I to do photography back then, as an artist, was just unheard of. And, now it's pretty common. And to use text was pretty unheard of, and now it's pretty common. I think one of the things I wanted to do was to make them both acceptable, and I didn't do it single-handedly, of course, but at least to get them on a par, with other art ways of doing art. And now that's so, but even for a long while, photography in a museum survey would be getaways. You have the painting in front and the photography in the back of the bus, so to speak. Now more and more people are learning to make a mix of things, which is good.
Do you think they're pretty much even now?
You could argue that one either way. I think on one hand you could say there's more photography, the same video around in painting. If you hate the art market, you're going to say there's more painting around photography and video. But I think, you know, I'm like this matchmaker in some way, and I'm trying to introduce painting to photography and photography to painting, and I'm having this strange kind of child as a result of, you know, this, you know, it's like trying to put a square peg in a round hole. It's just not going to work. But nevertheless, I'm going to keep, you know, trying, you know, to make this marriage in some way. I mean, I can't do straight painting. I can't do straight photography. I mean, I'm hooked somehow. And it's an impossible task.
I was going to ask you about a little bit to do with the way that you choose images and you process images, because obviously there's just the stuff that you did choose, there's thousands of images, and you always put these together, and there's never very rarely, I mean, the one thing that struck me, go through all the books of yours, there's never a single image on one page. There's always more than
I think that's, you know, that's one thing. Probably, you know, trying to sever my relationship to painting, where, you know, painting, you know, normally, let's say, you know, is a single rectangle or a square. And, you know, so one of the things that I wanted to do was, you know, really make that break. So I started to use multiple images. And then trying to use height-width relationships that weren't given. You know, I mean, there are a lot, you know, the golden mean sort of thing. You get a lot in painting unless you decide to just to question that. And I did not really question that when I was a painter, because I said, well, you know, whatever size you want. But the interesting thing about photography is that you have preordained sizes, 8x10, 11x14, 22x24. And your camera, a viewfinder, you know, is a certain height-width relationship unless you're using a panoramic camera. And so that really annoyed me, and I began using a twin-lens reflex and just, you know, putting a mask in, like a circle or a triangle or whatever, or a long rectangle, and just composing through that just to get away from it. And then, you know, begin to architecturally build up images, rather than have a single one. But I think another reason for that, too, was that I've always been fascinated with language, and I think I tend to build up compositions like a writer will build with words. You know, one word, the right, well, as Flaubert said, the right word after the right word. And so I don't prioritize, you know, I don't think an image is more important than a word. I don't think a word is more important than an image. And for many years, I would use them interchangeably. And sometimes now I'll get back to image and text, sometimes this text, sometimes this image. And again, it's something I just can't make a choice, you know.
I was going to ask you about make a choice, I guess, but in terms of the images that you do select, I think I read somewhere that you kept files and categories, people on horses, people with guns, people with arms, and somehow, but then the interesting thing, a lot of your early work, the idea of making a choice was in fact almost your subject matter, I suppose. You had the commission paintings that people are probably familiar with, where I think maybe it was your friend walks along and he points, you take a photograph, he walks along, points to something else, they take a photograph, and then you present them to commercial painters who then choose an image, and
exactly.
And then there's the thing, the green bean piece, where you have three beans and there's a finger by it, and take the two that you don't choose away and put two new ones in. And now you, it seems to be, I don't know, I just wondered how now, noticing that how has this filtered into your selection of images that you do choose?
The constant reappearing of the finger, it would be an indicator of making a choice. A lot of my early work was trying to find out in some Cartesian fashion, you know, like, what was art? You know, and it is very base, you know, at lowest level, you know, and I, and one of the, for me anyway, was that it's about making a choice, you know, this thing over that, or what are you going to put in, what are you going to leave out?
It's kind of like the first semantic gesture.
Yeah. And it seemed to be that was essentially art making, and anything beyond that was embroidery. And I think that still obtains. I still work out, you know, strategies for myself where that I'm not just trying to get make something that's beautiful, because, you know, I said earlier, you can't get the painter out of your system. So the beauty thing's going to be there. No matter, you know, it's going to be like toilet paper to your shoe. You know, you can't get rid of it. It's always going to be there.
And then also, I suppose, as you set up this a lot of these sort of games or almost or structures you put in place to then that sort of predetermine almost what images, but then you almost sort of expose it as a little bit ridiculous. I watched your inventory film again last week, and you know, you have to start with a small object and get to and these objects to one side, and first of all you put a glass bead and marble, and then there's this great bit halfway through where you apologise because there's some objects you'd like to have shown, but in fact you're already a bigger object than these ones.
I can't go backwards.
and it seems like that's something to do with. That translates into what you're doing in general.
I think so. It's making an a priori structure that's not too tight or not too loose. So it doesn't allow for total chaos, but it's not so restrictive that it can't be imaginative and, you know, and playful and fun and whatever, you know. And I think a lot, you know, I always, metaphorically, sometimes I thought about my work as like a detective novel, and you're dropping clues, and the reader's thinking, aha, I've got it, and then you don't. And then you drop some more clues, and you go down another path, and you say, now I've got it, and then, no, you don't. And the whole idea, though, is to keep the spectator engaged enough where he doesn't close the book half-finished and say, I'm through with this guy.
It's interesting you mentioned detective novel. Actually, I had something that I stumbled across I really wanted to ask you about. I felt like I found a story that somehow was maybe somehow shed some light on what I thought you might be up to. But it was an Edgar Allan Poe tale, and it's called The Purloined Letter. I
don't know.
And so I guess people are familiar with it to some extent, but the chief of the police know that this letter's hidden somewhere in the room, and they employ the most meticulous search. They grid it inch by inch, and they search with a microscope every possible inch to find this letter in the room. And the chief of police comes to Dupin, and he says, it's there, but we can't find it. And Dupin walks into the room, and he knows that the guy who's hidden the letter is actually also, as well as a mathematician, he's also a poet. So of course he finds the letter just out on the letter rack in the open, just on the only place that, I mean, outside of the logic that the police
possibly extend to do it.
And when I read that story and thought about the way that you sort of jumping ahead to what I was going to ask you about later, but it seems relevant, and the way you conceal things and you hide things, but you also sort of an emphatic concealment because it becomes completely obvious because you block them out with colour. But this relationship to the detective story and these two different types of logic that people can solve clues with, I guess.
I think a lot of my modus is attributable to having having taught to support myself, and then deciding that if I'm going to have to teach, I'm going to make that as much like art as I can, so I'm not bored. But doing that, I think I've learned a lot about what it takes to engage another person, and so that's filtered back into my art, and where I'm not. You know, you don't want to be lecture, and you don't want to be confused, so confusing you don't know what you're talking about either, but somewhere in between where you're actually in some Socratic way, you know, you're taking people where they are and bringing up to them to a point that they might not have realized about themselves.
Going back to this theme, I think it's the most, for me, it was the most striking and the most sort of poetic element of all the stuff, the this sort of presence of absence thing. Something's there, but what you keep away, and also you seem to be generously giving things.
I think
but
you're
at
right,
the same
yeah.
time, you're like,
yeah.
there's always this barrier that. But it's you so obvious quite, that I don't quite know where to look.
Exactly,
and I'm peering around the edge.
I know. Well, one of the best compliments I ever got was the Nam June Paik, whom I taught with at Cal Arts, and I guess it was 70 to 72, and then he left and went back to New York. But he said what he liked best about my work was what I left out.
Yeah, I think this seems to be...
And that's a big theme, you know, and again, that's about choice, you know, that how much can you leave out of something, how much, let's say, fat you can cleave off of something where you haven't, you know, killed, I'm going to mix a metaphor, where you haven't killed a patient.
on that thing, I guess one of the images, I was trying to work out, I mean, as we mentioned before, about how there wasn't, I mean, how almost a radical a break it was to bring in photography and text, something that I couldn't. So I was trying to work out what your predecessors were or something, or like, and there was a few things I was knocking around, maybe Fluxus, but then I came to Magritte and I thought of the image of the Son of Man with the apple in front of the face.
You know, I honestly got to say, I never saw that piece until much later. I know it's hard to believe, but it's really true. But I also believe art comes out of art. You know, I mean, you know, nobody can you know be that original where you arise full blown.
It's strange because I think I read somewhere on a Greek book, and he said he only went to New York once, and it was just for a show. But he stopped hanging his show to dash off to visit Edgar Allan Poe's house. This was the only thing that really interested him about going to America. And, and there was just, I was trying to work out about, I don't know, the relationship, like some of the surrealist things, and how it just didn't seem obvious. I don't know, maybe it is, or consideration in relation to the way you put images together.
I mean, I like Magritte a lot, you know, and of course I'm very attracted to surrealism and Dada and you know, that whole bent of art and romanticism and, you know, symbolism and so on. Yeah, I have no argument with that premise at all.
I guess the other thing.
Ja, wir verabschieden uns hier im Studio. Das war jetzt John Baldessari im Gespräch mit Andy Holden und Tobi Meyer. Ja, vielen Dank. Thank you very much for joining us.
Tschüss.
So.
Tschüss.
Yeah, and whenever it starts, it's the right time. So, Kunstverein. Von jetzt bis 6. Mai. Okay, bye.
Sprechstunde jeden vierten Freitag im Monat von 16 bis 17 Uhr auf Radio X.